I'm trying to say The Double, written in 1846 by Fyodor Dostoevsky. The Double, written in 1846 by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky. Comrade Dostoevsky. Comrade Dostoevsky. That's... I feel like that's offensive. I probably shouldn't say that. What do you know? I've actually released an episode. Today we're talking about The Double, Enemy, and The Double. Plus, my Cinebad pig is more of a person than an idea. All that and more, in my own words. Welcome back. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. It is, in fact, my birthday right now. And I'm really happy about it. I don't know if you all have noticed this, but it's been a while since I've released anything at all. No quick words, no reviews, no official episodes, nothing. And I can tell you why. It is because I was engrossed in this episode so much that it burrowed its way into my daily habits. I couldn't function. I was so destroyed. I lost my sense of self because of this review. That's not true at all. What really has happened is that I have been swamped for about 2 weeks now, and I am recording this on the day it is going to be released. I don't like that. I like to have some time in between. Now, it's not the only time this has happened, but it's the most recent and it's very noticeable, and I am unhappy about it. So that's enough about me. Let's move into today's topic. This episode is titled Double the Doubles Times 2, because holy cow, what a weird world that we live in. I'm going to be talking about one movie called Enemy, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. I will also be talking about another film called The Double, starring Jesse Eisenberg. These films are eerily similar. They are so similar that I thought they were based on the same book. I truly did. I thought they were both based on The Double by Fyodor the old strange names. That I don't know. It's Russian, I think, so give me some grace here. The Double, written in 1846 by Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I'll get into that book, but let's just say that it's not the only book of the same topic. In fact, there was another book by the name of The Double, written in 2002 by Jose Saramago. I don't understand why this is happening. I don't get why there are so many copies of a story about a copy of a person. It's insane. And then the two movies, Enemy and The Double, both doppelganger movies, they both came out in 2013. They each were a loose, very, very loose remake of the book. But they were each made after one of those books. It is insane. It is the strangest phenomenon. And I'm lost. I'm lost as to why this is the universe that we live in. But you know what's the best one we got? So we're going to get into these films. We are going to start by talking about what a doppelganger is, because that definition is important moving forward, and just the definition of the doppelganger that I have elected to use instead of just a simple, it's a lookalike. It's a very good historical definition of doppelganger, and it gives us a better literary understanding of these films and what they signify and the significance of this story, of both the stories. Pay attention, this is complicated, having all of these copies around here. Well, before we dive in, the definition of doppelganger. A doppelganger is defined as a non-biologically related lookalike or double of a living person, sometimes portrayed as a ghostly or paranormal phenomenon and usually seen as a harbinger of bad luck. So let's get into our first film of the day, Enemy, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. Enemy, which came out in 2013, focuses on history teacher Adam Bell, who, in the midst of a listless depression, rents a movie and finds his physical doppelganger as an actor named Anthony Clare. So our two Jake Gyllenhaals that we're going to have to keep track of are Adam, the teacher, and Anthony, the actor. Now let's get into this film because it's not really about what you think it's about. And if you do a quick Google search on Enemy, you're going to find some pictures that don't sound at all like the movie I've just described. Because Enemy has some of the most famous, I guess, screenshots of any movie out there because of the strange use of a very specific symbol, which we will cover in graphic detail. Now, the opening shot of this movie, it is the city, which is a significant character in the film. This opening shot of the city, a lot of the establishing shots will be of this nameless city, and it is coated in this yellow filter, which permeates the entire movie. Everything has this yellow, sickly glow, and this yellow fog just rests on every shot of the city, and it slowly gets thicker and it slowly gets darker throughout the film based on your interpretation, but it is intentional in this film. So we're looking at the city. The camera slowly pans over. We hear Adam's mother disliking his apartment in a phone call. It's leaving a message on Adam's answering machine about how no man should live like Adam is, and it's just uncomfortable, and he needs to call her back. And of course it ends with saying she loves him and will talk to him soon. That is being played over a shot of Anthony sitting in his car, who is waiting to enter what we will soon find out, this building he's about to enter. Trust me, it's shocking. We then have a quick shot of Anthony's wife, who is alone in bed. Anthony's wife is 6 months pregnant, we find out later in the film. She is noticing Anthony's absence. He seems to have a habit of not being home at night with his wife, and instead often entertains the company of other women. Then we get the nugget, the key, if you will, to unlocking this film. Simply a quote in yellow lettering on a black screen. It reads, "Chaos is order yet undeciphered." That's intentional. In doing research for this episode, the director made sure we knew there was a legitimate answer and interpretation of this film. He didn't put in the scenes I will go on to describe as just filler, just psychological horror mumbo jumbo nonsense. And it is in fact an intentional film that appears at first to be just chaos, and we have no idea what it's going on, what's trying to happen on screen. We cannot understand it. Instead, the director is telling us right off the bat, every shot's intentional, and you may need to think through what you're about to watch. Then we get the opening shot, and this, let me set the scene. It's shocking the first time you watch this movie because it is not what you're expecting at all when you rent a doppelganger film. Or you can watch it on Netflix. It is on Netflix. As of today, I rewatched it right before this recording to get some of my details right. It's still on Netflix. So I would suggest, if you're okay with some graphic nudity, go ahead, watch it. And if you're scared of spiders, do not watch this movie. The opening shot is Anthony attending what looks like some kind of secret club for the rich and powerful. Imagine Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. It's a secret, seedy club with rich and powerful men sitting around watching a sex show. Anthony enters using a very specific key. That's important. I'm going to need you to take that key and put it on the bulletin board. Just stick a pin in it. Put it right up there. We will catch up with that key later on. It's very, very important. I did not know how important until I watched the movie a second time. Anthony walks into this seedy sex club and he begins to watch the show. Soon a lady brings out a tray which has the look that it's going to be some kind of delicacy. She opens the lid and out walks a large tarantula. And it is a gross looking spider. It's a good 6-7 inch diameter spider. It is upsetting. Not the biggest spider in the movie. And it crawls out. The lady disrobes and places her high-heeled foot just above the spider, implying that she will crush it. We do not see that. The scene quickly changes to our introduction of our main protagonist, Adam Bell. He also has a metaphorical key to understanding this story. That's three keys we were given right at the beginning of this film. And we're not a minute in. This movie hasn't begun yet, and there's so much your mind has to keep track of. It's unbelievable, but don't worry. I am here. I will unveil and unravel this knowledge to you so that you can understand this Rubik's Cube of a film. Adam is lecturing about dictators and totalitarian regimes throughout history. He mentions the Roman Empire, the Nazi government, the Marxist revolutions, and he mentions some key points. What's important visually, before I get to those key points, what's important about the scene behind him is he has all of these terms throughout history, and they're connected through a web, if you will. It is intentional that he is standing in front of a web of information, and it shows how close that web is to Adam. Well, what he says is also very important. He specifically mentions how totalitarian governments will use entertainment and satisfying carnal needs in a society to lure in people to be submissive to this regime. And the ultimate goal of the regime is to destroy the individual identity of its subjects. And by luring them into this trap, they will ensnare people. He then mentions an important quote from our lovely Karl Marx that history repeats itself twice. First as a tragedy and then as a farce. This idea of duality and this repetition of a pattern is also very important, not only fitting with the spiders and web metaphor, but also fitting with the overall ideas of the film. And we're going to get to the interpretations later. Right now, just keep all this information ready to go, because if you were watching the movie, you would also be expected to keep all of this information ready to go. Well, he does not like movies. He has a very strict schedule where he wakes up, he teaches the same lectures, he goes home, he sleeps with his girlfriend, and that's it. That's his life. That's all he does. It's simple, it's boring, and it is leading to a bit of a depression where he wants something different. He wants something exciting in his life. Well, he asks about a movie. I guess I should say someone else asks him if he likes movies. He doesn't really like movies, but he asks, could he watch something happy that would cheer him up. Well, this other teacher advises he watches Where There's a Will, There's a Way. Adam rents this movie and watches it, noticing something startling that will eventually destroy his life. He sees himself. He sees someone in this movie that looks just like him. So he quickly researches and finds who was in this movie, and he finds his doppelganger, Anthony Clare. He then hunts down Anthony's mailbox, finds his mail, a confidential envelope that includes the address. With that address, he then finds Anthony's personal phone number. At that point, he calls Anthony, and they discover each other. Anthony, of course, doesn't like that this call has come through and believes it's a stalker. Anthony's wife believes it was a woman that Anthony was cheating with. And there's this subtle distrust. But all throughout these scenes, Anthony mentions what he's seen in a magazine or what he has watched in TV. And his life is dictated by the entertainment industry. Being an actor, this is not surprising. But everything he does has to do with perception and the industry and others and what they think of him. He decides to meet up with Adam. They go to a hotel. Now, before this hotel meetup, Adam has a nightmare in which he's walking down a hotel hallway. A woman walks on the ceiling towards him with the head of a spider. It's uncomfortable. It is off-putting. Then, the next day, he arrives at the hotel. The camera follows the... I'm thinking of how to put this because I want my podcast to be family friendly, but it's a hard R movie. It follows the rear end of a short-skirted woman. We are led to believe she might be a prostitute. We don't fully know, but we're led to believe that. We do not see this woman's face, but she walks by Adam. Adam notices her and is uncomfortable, I believe, due to the familiarity of the setup. And I use that word familiarity not just to refer to the dream, but to some of the interpretations later on. Anthony and Adam meet. They both have the same scar on their chest. Their hands are the same. The only difference, and this is the key when you're watching the movie to keep everything straight, the only difference is that Anthony has a wedding ring as he is married. Adam does not. Adam freaks out at this point. Adam flees and says, this is not a good idea. We should never meet up again. He quickly gets in his car, drives away, and drives home. Anthony drives up to his car on his motorcycle, looks incredibly threatening when wearing the helmet, and then drives off. Anthony tells his wife that his wife won't have to worry about that other person anymore. Adam is shook up by this entire development, and he doesn't want Anthony anywhere near his life. It has scared him so much what has happened. He then visits his mother to talk about this incident. Now, I should mention that during this meeting, Adam did leave that confidential envelope and gave it back to Anthony. That's a quick little detail, but it's something to keep track of. Well, Adam, the next day, or time is difficult in this movie, I'm going to be real with you. The next scene, Adam is with his mother talking about this incident, talking about how strange it was meeting his doppelganger. The mother just disregards this, doesn't really care, doesn't seem interested, but instead continues to tell Adam what he should do in his life. Now, she's not mean or berating, but you can tell there's a bit of a power dynamic with this relationship, and Adam seems to always be just taking orders, not living his own life. And then we get the first wrench thrown into this movie's interpretation. Just, it messes you up when you watch the movie. Because at this point, we are at the beginning of the third act, and you get a city shot like you have been seeing throughout. In the smoky yellow haze, a massive spider lingers over the city. This thing is huge. This thing towers above the highest buildings in this city. We're talking enormous spider. And it looms over the city. It is a terrifying sight. The legs are so long. I mean, skyscraper length legs crawling through this city. Its eyes are watching this city, imposing on these people. And this thing, this giant spider, looks large, uncontrollable, evil, and it is watching everything. It is upsetting. And then we get to see what Anthony has been up to. Anthony has tracked down Adam's girlfriend. He has stalked her. He's watched where she's gone, and he has lusted after her, wanting what he can't have. And we know that Anthony has had problems with women that are not his wife. We know he has an uncontrollable urge. He is almost dictated by his desires. So he comes up with a scheme. He then corners Adam and tells him he will be out of his life under one condition. He will leave Adam alone if he gets one weekend getaway with Adam's girlfriend. They will exchange clothes. Anthony will take on the persona of Adam in order to have, if you will, his girlfriend. Anthony has to have what is truly Adam's. Adam agrees. Anthony dresses up, removes his ring, and then lies to Adam's girlfriend. They leave for the weekend in Adam's car. Adam then walks over to Anthony's penthouse. The doorman lets him in. The doorman then has a very interesting conversation with what he believes is Anthony. He then states that he hasn't stopped thinking about the night at the sex club. That scene we saw at the beginning, well, it's starting to come back. He then says to Adam, who he believes is Anthony, that he needs to go back. He doesn't just want to go back, he needs it. It is a carnal need that has touched his soul. He is dictated by his desires to go back. Adam says he is unsure if he can make it happen. Adam is trying to keep up this farce, if you will, of being Anthony. He's led into Anthony's apartment. Soon after this, Anthony's wife returns. She is confused as to why Anthony is in her house, since Anthony had given some story about visiting his mother over the weekend. Adam lies and states that he's changed his mind and wants to stay. Adam is riddled with guilt during these scenes, and it comes across as strange turmoil, but upon viewing this movie a second time, I can tell it is guilt that he is feeling for what he is trying to do. Meanwhile, Anthony takes Adam's girlfriend to the same hotel room that Adam and Anthony met in earlier in the movie. They then begin to sleep together. Adam, meanwhile, can't make a move on Anthony's wife. He is unable to. He's unable to sleep that night. He walks out and sits on the couch. He's shaking. His head is in his hands. He's sweating profusely. He's upset about what's going on. And this is intercut with scenes of Anthony and Adam's girlfriend in the hotel room. Well, something starts to happen. First, we see Anthony's wife come out and console the man she believes is her husband. Meanwhile, Adam's girlfriend notices the mark on Anthony's hand where there was a wedding ring. They have an argument. They freak out. She doesn't know who this man is, even though it looks and acts just like her boyfriend. We cut back to Anthony's wife wanting to sleep with her husband. Adam, though riddled with guilt, concedes and decides to give in to his desires, almost as if they are dictated to him. Then on the drive back, we see Anthony angrily berating Adam's girlfriend. Adam's girlfriend has one final line where she says, "I don't know who you are. You're not a man." And then she hits the steering wheel. The car veers, hits a side barrier, flips, and crushes the two of them. The window is broken in a pattern that looks eerily similar to a spider's web. The next morning, Adam wakes up. He is using Anthony's toothbrush. He is getting ready for the day. Anthony's wife reminds him that his mother called, and he needs to call her back. He seems to have slipped right into Anthony's life. In fact, he has taken everything that is not his. He now has become Anthony. He finds a picture on the mantle that is the exact same picture he owned in his own apartment. Essentially, that scene is telling us he has become Anthony. He has taken over Anthony's life. Adam then finds that confidential envelope from the beginning. Throughout this movie, we've seen it. He opens it, and out falls that key. Remember, I told you to put a pin in it? Put it up on that board? That key that led to the sex club. He holds it in his hands, puts it in his pocket, walks around the corner, and then we have the most famous scene in the movie. The final shot, he walks in to talk to his wife. She has become a giant tarantula. And that's the last scene of the movie. That's it. That's what you're left with. Adam rounding the corner, pretending to be Anthony, to Anthony's wife, who has become, I guess, or given birth to, the interpretations are different, a giant tarantula that is huddled in the corner. That is the only scene of this movie that my wife saw. And she was very confused, almost as confused as me. And I had seen the whole movie. I didn't understand a thing after watching this hour and a half movie. So I'll admit that some of these interpretations I did get some help with, though I have my own and I will express what it is. So I am not lying by stating that it is in my own words. I would like to talk about the two main theories about this movie and the main interpretations. The first interpretation is that it is really about the slow background takeover of a totalitarian dictatorship. And the symbol that is used, of course, is the spider and the spider's web. How the spider is a threat that hides and can sneak its way into your homes, into your closet, your shoe, and without you knowing it, suddenly you're ensnared and wrapped up in this web that you didn't even see was being built around your life. That's why the spider is used as the symbol. And a great way to look at it is the first time we see it is in this meeting of great minds at a sex club. These people all look wealthy, old, powerful. They include men. They're all men. They include men that are leaders, government workers. They're wearing suits. We have what appears to be the stereotype banker people. And then you have Anthony, an actor, a member of the entertainment industry. Now, remember Adam's lesson where he talks about how government leaders would use entertainment and distractions and the carnal desires of man to lure their way into control. That can be seen with, of course, the sex club at the beginning, but also with Adam's switch. His desire for an exciting life and his inevitable desire to take what is not his. You see, he met Anthony's wife at one point, did not know who she was, just happened to talk to her. When he talked to her, he was nice, polite, talking about how great it is that she's pregnant. And then he ends up in the end taking her from Anthony, taking what's not his. He is unable to not perform the act and take what's not his. Because of this desire in him, this weak part of himself, that is used by the system, society, for him to eventually become so wrapped up in this totalitarian government that he didn't even see. And that's part of the theme with this interpretation, that the movie never shows it. It's a silent takeover. The only hints that you have are the spiders. We don't see what's going on. All we see is that Adam is confused by this and it has overtaken his mind. Anthony is a part of this society and he is a fully fleshed out member of this, I guess I'll call it, spider conspiracy. Adam slowly is lured into this world. And that picture that really threw a curveball at me when I first watched it, why that picture is in the same place, it is because Adam and Anthony are two sides of the same coin. There's the everyman that doesn't want a dictatorship or a totalitarian watchdog government over him. And then there is the other man who is benefited by this government, whose life is wealthy and powerful. He goes to these clubs. He has a wife and a child on the way. He's lured in and becomes a member of that. And we see that transformation, how one man can go from living an independent life to being owned by a marriage, by the society, by the government, until he has the realization when he walks in to see his wife, there's a giant spider, a danger in his bedroom. Now, the other interpretation, which I'll admit I originally held, but after seeing the evidence, I tend to hold to the totalitarian government theory. But I originally held this theory, and that is the spiders represent Adam and Anthony's fear of women and fear of intimacy. You see, Adam and Anthony are both in a domineering relationship with all of the women in their lives. The women tend to control them. And though Anthony may think he's in control of women, the reality is that he is completely owned by his lustful desires for women. He's married and spends an entire day watching a woman he's not even married to, that he has no right to take from this other man. Adam has this pattern in his life where he just goes to work. He comes home, he drinks, he sleeps with his girlfriend leaves. His girlfriend, sure, she has her own life, but Adam just needs her there for sexual companionship. And it's very boring and depressing, and it's just, and he's owned by it. He can't get out of it. It's part of him that he can't stop. He also is told what to do by his mother, and his mother's words just hurt him, and he can't stand up for himself when he talks to his mother. So he has this innate fear of women. Women are this predatory thing that sneaks in and then they get their fangs in you. When Adam is around Anthony's wife, there's no spider. Spiders are not present when they're talking. But then, when he finally has sex with Anthony's wife, the next morning, she becomes a giant spider, an incredible predator that Anthony is powerless against. Similar to how when we first saw the giant spider, it was the next scene after Adam was talking to his mother. The first spider in the movie was small and manageable. Anthony was managing his lust. Little did he know that by going to that sex club, he would eventually become so ensnared in a web which overlays his dead body at the end of the movie. The web imagery from the power lines and streetcar cables that we see throughout, they become messier and increase in thickness and entanglement as Adam is slowly lured into this psychosexual thriller that he has created for himself out of boredom. And then, of course, there's the woman whose head was of a spider. And in the next scene, Adam sees the prostitute that is walking down the hallway, and she's alluring in the body, but is also dangerous. That's a good interpretation, and it fits. It really does fit, especially because there is a statue in, I believe, Philadelphia, maybe Pittsburgh, of Mammon, which translates roughly to mother, and this statue looks like the giant spider in the movie. So there is some evidence for this theory, but personally, I like the totalitarian government angle of this movie, how just like a spider can slip in unnoticed, build its fortress and its trap, and without even knowing what's happened, we the prey can slip in and become so entangled that before long we will realize we have become ensnared. And by the time we see that giant looming spider, it is far, far too late. Well, let's do some good, bad, and ugly, shall we? The good. The cinematography, of course, in both of these movies, the good will include the cinematography. They're both very well filmed. The tone with that yellow filter over everything and the fog and then the random scenes with spiders. I mean, this is insane. You feel like something horrible is going to happen without even seeing a threat. The idea of meeting a doppelganger and the chaos that that can cause is really upsetting. The whole movie just feels wrong, like you're watching something that you shouldn't be watching. And I love it. I love every part of it. That tone, right on point. And the acting, as always, Jake Gyllenhaal does a fantastic job. He appears scared, weak when necessary. He can portray that menacing, power-hungry egomaniac, and he's fantastic at it. And Jake Gyllenhaal shines when he is threatening. That is his best trait. When he appears weak and then all of a sudden becomes a threatening menace, oh my gosh, he shines at that. He is great at being crazy. The bad of the movie. The bad. Let's see. The slow start. And when I talked about the beginning of this film, there was a lot in the first 30 seconds, but it's a lot to keep track of. And then you have this slow burn. And it's very interesting. Don't worry. It's not just dialogue for the sake of dialogue. It's captivating. But you want more going on. You want to see more. And that's probably intentional, because out of nowhere, you see giant spiders. And you're pretty interested. So don't worry. It's not too slow. I would also say that the ending, that final scene with the tarantula, is a bit anticlimactic. It is widely regarded as the most terrifying and shocking ending, but it just happens. and you're confused, and then the movie ends. There you go. That's it. It's one and done. So I would say that a little bit more build-up, maybe a few tweaks to the editing, but really, I gotta say this movie's pretty awesome. So those are only there because I have to have a bad, and nothing is perfect. So there's always something to improve on. And finally, the ugly. I would say the most disturbing for this movie. All of the scenes with the spiders. Every scene with a spider is horrible and disturbing. The opening scene with that club was very upsetting. And the ending scene with the giant spider, also very upsetting. Though short, like I said, though quick, was quite upsetting, especially when you understand the implication, when you're looking at it as he is trapped, whether it's in an intimacy that he feels is threatening, or whether it's he is now a part of this totalitarian conspiracy, he's trapped and he has become the prey. Well, we're going to take a quick break here from our favorite sponsor, as always. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about the same story, but different, with The Double. Stick around. The Double, starring Jesse Eisenberg, was also released in 2013. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating that these two films came out in the same year and yet are so different, just like both of their stories. Now, The Double, starring Jesse Eisenberg, is based on the 1846 novel, The Double, whereas Enemy was based on the 2002 novel, The Double. I know it's very confusing, since everything's got the same name, except for one piece of media. But don't worry. Don't worry. You don't have to keep track of it. I kept track of it. I did it all for you. But let's get started with The Double, the 2013 film starring Jesse Eisenberg. This film is not near as deep and not near as complicated. It is considered a thriller slash black comedy. It's very dystopian. Very, very dystopian. And if you've seen the movie Snowpiercer, it's very similar to that. It's almost comically dystopian. If you've seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when they arrive at the Volgar planet, and all creativity is stifled, and all the buildings are square, boring blocks. That's what it's like. However, the movie does need a little bit of explaining, and I like it. It's a very cool movie, and I would suggest both of them are definitely must-watch films. The Double is a great film. It's PG-13, I think. It may be R, but I think it's PG-13, whereas Enemy is hard R, and Enemy you have to decipher, and when you understand the interpretation, you can watch it a second time. It's a whole lesson. Whereas The Double is, you watch it once, you understand it roughly, you can talk about it, but you roughly get what happened. So, what does happen, in fact? Well, the setting is, like I said, the dystopian setting. It's very gray and a lot of business buildings and things are square. Some of the technology is far advanced, whereas some technology looks like it's right out of 1905. And that's intentional. It feels like a fable as you're watching it, like something you would read as a short story. And that's the best way to look at it, since it is based on a novella. That's the best way to look at it. So let's dive in to what happens in the movie, and I'm going to give you a quick summary, and we'll unpack as we go. The downtrodden Simon James, played by Jesse Eisenberg, has worked at his office for 7 years, but he is ignored by his boss and his colleagues. From his apartment, he's able to watch the beautiful coworker of his named Hannah. And he admires her, and he is head over heels for Hannah. She lives in the apartment that is across from him, so he shares a lot of symmetry in those scenes, and it's beautifully shot, but he watches her. He'll watch her throw away her art, which she paints and creates after her work hours at her dull, boring government job, bureaucratic. You can just imagine it. It's like a fable. But she does art afterwards, and then if she's not satisfied, she'll throw it away. Well, Simon secretly does retrieve those from the trash can, and he admires the art. Well, one day, Simon sees a man jump to his death from the floor above Hannah's apartment. He talks to the detectives and the police, and the detectives explain that if he had jumped just a few feet to the right, he would have been badly hurt, but he would have survived by the time the ambulances arrived. Simon's boss announces the arrival. Now, this is the next day. Simon's boss announces the arrival of a brand new employee who will change everything. James Simon, also played by Eisenberg, looks identical to Simon James. I'm sorry, the names are, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but I like it. This causes Simon to faint when James arrives. Assertive and charming, James is Simon's polar opposite. Much to Simon's annoyance, James not only gets respect from both of their coworkers, but no one seems to notice that they are both identical. James, on the other hand, does notice this and sees Simon's pain. Out of pity, he decides to buddy up with Simon and give him advice on how to seduce Hannah. Hannah then asks James on a date through Simon. She does that ever painful friend zone thing where she asks Simon to ask James if James would like to go out on a date with her. It's very funny in the movie because she is asking Simon, who is identical to James, to ask James out. It's very funny and it's uncomfortable, but it plays into a lot of those he's just like me insecurities that men have, and it's just a fun scene. It's strange, dark, sad, but hilarious. It's done very well, and I love it. I love that scene. Well, during the date, Simon pretends to be James. You see, they did the old switcheroo, the old Cyrano de Bergerac. Simon is pretending to be James, and the real James is giving him instructions through an earpiece. When Simon becomes too nervous, they swap, and James kisses Hannah. This angers Simon. He is upset. Well, James then asks Simon to take an aptitude test in his place. During that aptitude test, James seduces their boss's surly, rebellious daughter, Melanie, whom Simon was reluctantly hired to tutor for that aptitude test. Simon decides at that point to get his revenge on James by revealing to Hannah that James is cheating on her with Melanie. At this point, you start to see that Simon is becoming more forthright with himself. He is acting in a way that may be uncomfortable, but he believes is right and what he's owed. He has taken that step to become closer to what James is like. James, you'll notice throughout, is more of a facade and not a genuine person. In fact, is an incredibly selfish person. Well, furious about what had just happened, James blackmails Simon for his apartment keys using explicit photos he took of himself with Melanie, knowing that their boss would believe it is Simon. At work, Simon accuses James of being an imposter, and he is fired after going on this maniacal tirade. That is where this movie shines. That tirade, that scene where he is freaking out. He at one point grabs a man's prosthetic arm, waving it in front of himself, looking at the hand. That's a powerful scene because he's looking at something that is fake but designed to appear real. And that is the ultimate question of identity. Something that is a facade of reality, but is not real, and is, in fact, an imposter. Well, Simon goes home and is incredibly depressed. Well, he doesn't really have a home. He has lost his home to James, but he is incredibly depressed. And Simon is about to kill himself when he sees Hannah lying unconscious in her apartment. He calls an ambulance and accompanies her to the hospital, where it is revealed that she not only overdosed, but also miscarried. She had become pregnant after a sexual encounter with James. Simon then takes Hannah back home, relieved that she has survived. Still upset, however, Hannah states that she wanted to die. And then she even suggests that Simon should kill himself too. There is this idea of overbearing, overwhelming oppression and depression throughout this movie. And you see people just commit suicide. And it's commonplace, and it's just something that happens. And it's one of those inability to connect with others and the lonesomeness that has destroyed these people as they live under what appears to be a dystopian, totalitarian regime. They feel that they can't connect with other people, and they can't be, here's the key idea, they cannot be their true selves. She, at that point, moving back to the movie, at that point, Hannah goes through Simon's jacket pockets and discovers her earrings that he had bought for her, as well as some of her old art that she threw away. And this is when Hannah starts to understand there's more to Simon than there is to James. She understands that Simon, while he can act out when he becomes irate, she understands that Simon understands true beauty in the art and understands value and actually cares for Hannah. Well, after this, Simon has another outburst. You see, he learns that his mother has died, and he finds James at her funeral. Simon attacks and punches James, and at this point he discovers that they share injuries. He attacks James, hits him, and then his head hurts, and they both have wounds on their head from the punch. As James' nose bleeds, Simon's also bleeds. He finds Hannah and tells her he wants to be noticed, and that's key. When he goes to her apartment and says, "I want to be noticed," that is it. He wants people to notice him, and no one has noticed him. Even computers don't know he's there. Cameras don't see him. He is unable to be seen, and he wants someone to notice him. Well, then he walks away. He just knocked on her door and told her that. And then before she was able to retort, he leaves because he has a plan. He goes to his apartment, and he handcuffs the sleeping James to his bed. Then he goes to the ledge above Hannah's apartment, steps to the right, and jumps. He lands on the ground, badly hurt. Hannah runs to him. An ambulance arrives. But, you see, someone else got injured. Simon is getting medical treatment, while James, lacking medical attention, appears to be on the brink of death as he lies motionless on the apartment floor, his head bleeding out. Inside the ambulance, the colonel, and I'll get to the colonel in a second, and Hannah watch over Simon. The colonel tells Simon that he is special, to which the latter responds with a half smile. He then says, "I'd like to think I'm pretty unique." And that's an interesting end to the movie. Now, before we get too far, you're probably wondering, who is the colonel? I never heard about him. He's not really in the story. He's on the television. Throughout the movie, the colonel is giving messages. He is the one in charge. He's the military dictator of this entire society. And he's this idealized image. And everyone wants to please the colonel. and the colonel is revered. Children love him. Everyone is raised to believe that the colonel is a wonderful, amazing man. Leading a country where people kill themselves regularly and are unnoticed. There's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek irony there. You can see that this colonel is this amazing, benevolent personality when he's not helping anybody. So why does he show up for Simon? That's because Simon finally achieved the genuine artifacts that James pretended to be. You see, the idea of a true self needing balance is the message of the film. You have to have balance. The characters of the movie are all out of balance. They're all one-note characters. Boss is boss. That's all he is. Worker drones are worker drones. That's all they do, and then they kill themselves. It's very sad. But you see, Simon and Hannah have duality to their true selves. Simon wants to be noticed, which gives birth to James. I believe there's some magical, mystical, whatever you call it. His desire to be noticed, to be charming, to have all of these characteristics that are outflows of some of his good and some of his bad personality. They outflow and they create this manifestation, which is James. James' only trait is that he is noticed. He's noticed. He's scheming. That's all he is. He is outgoing, well-liked, and can't go without being noticed. See, Hannah wants to express herself outside of work and be loved and understood. She wants to have art and beauty, and she wants someone to appreciate her, the true her, not just the worker bee that is Hannah. And since James can only be noticed and there's nothing deeper to him, she is left truly unsatisfied with their relationship. Simon, however, is noticed by Hannah. He loves Hannah and her art and appreciates the true beauty of, I guess you could say, the inner Hannah, the creative side. Together, they fulfill in each other what society cannot, and more importantly, what the colonel and the government cannot. And that is why he's special. That's why the colonel is there, because they have created something genuine. And the colonel's there most likely to attempt a facade of it, to mass produce this kind of genuine connection. And we all know that that kind of connection, that true self and balanced self connecting with another person, is something that is not only beautiful, but only happens maybe once in a lifetime. And unfortunately, as much as many would like, the government cannot replace or manufacture genuine human connection. Now let's dive into the good, bad, and ugly. The good. The music was awesome. I loved the soundtrack of this movie. It had this dystopian, classic Russian orchestral piano and violin mix. It's really good, and it sets the tone perfectly. The cinematography, as I said, is great. The story, I like the story in this one. It was fun to watch, but uncomfortable at times and scary. And that's the point of these dystopian stories, is that you see a minor inconvenience that you experience in your life fully blossom and grown into a tragedy that has overtaken society. We've all gone through days where we're not noticed, and we sometimes feel like we don't matter. Now imagine an entire society built around you not mattering. It's horrible. It's tragic. But that's what makes these kind of films powerful. It's something we all feel, and it's expanded to be an entire society. That's what I love about those kind of movies. And that's what I love about Snowpiercer as well. It's an interesting interpretation, almost farce, of some of the problems in society. I guess you would call this a satire. of government power and totalitarian regimes, something both of these stories seem to share. The set design was phenomenal. The sets and the buildings and the lighting, it all worked really well together. And it created this atmosphere that even though it seemed horrible, you wanted to explore. It was this industrial, oppressive, working for the man kind of dystopian world that, I'll be honest, I really enjoy. Anytime I see that kind of dystopian future in a movie, I just love it, and I can't get enough of it. The Bad. It was twice the Jesse Eisenberg. It was two Jesse Eisenbergs talking to each other. Not that he's a bad actor, because he's a good actor. It's just some of his nuances are kind of annoying. And it does kind of get old. But it doesn't deter from the movie, but it's... I don't know. It can get old. It's not as bad as his performance as Lex Luthor, which was a travesty, and America should be ashamed that it let that happen. But still, it's a lot of Jesse Eisenberg. The ugly, or the most disturbing... It has to be when Simon has his freak out at work and he goes on that tirade and he's swinging that prosthetic arm. It's really upsetting. And I would also add the scene where he jumps off the roof and lands. Something about how it's filmed. In that next shot, he's holding his hand in front of his face, realizing he is the genuine article, not the prosthetic hand. It's a really cool scene. And I love how it was done. It was a cool way to end the movie. But it was also... a little disturbing. It's uncomfortable and freaky. I liked it. I really did like it. And that wraps up our two reviews on the same concept. What a world we live in. We're going to be right back with some Cinebad, and then we'll get you out of here. Just a little bit. Just real, real quick. Real, real quick. Stick around. For this week's Cinebad, I wanted to pick a director. Not just one movie. You see, he's directed three movies. And they're amazing. They're so bad that they're good. And that is a man by the name of Neil Breen. These movies are ridiculous. He's made three of them, which are Double Down, Fateful Findings, and I Am Here, now. This man is amazing. I would suggest that you go onto YouTube, type in Neil Breen, YMS, and watch YMS. He is a YouTube movie reviewer. Watch his video about Neil Breen's movies, because holy moly, this man is insane. He has so much fun and is just so bad at making movies. Every detail, from the sets all being in his house, to the fact that he destroys laptops that he obviously bought at Goodwill, to his line delivery, the fact that he's not an actor, and the fact that in all of his movies, he casts himself as an omnipotent god figure with unimaginable powers and no negative traits. It's insane. This man is bonkers. And I think he should be applauded and keep making movies, because holy cow, they are a treat to watch. I love every scene I've ever seen this man direct. It is awesome. Oh my gosh, absolutely love it. His editing's terrible. His music choice is terrible. And it's an absolute pleasure to watch. You will have so much fun watching these movies. Neil Breen. Look him up. And I would even buy his movies. They belong on everyone's shelves in America, because this man has given us such an amazing gift. And this has been In My Own Words. I am still Wes. I'm still here. I hope you're still here and you made it this far. I'd like to remind you that if you want to contact me, I'm everywhere. I am literally everywhere. You can just reach out. You'll probably touch me, But to write me something, that's a little more difficult. You're going to have to go to Instagram. I am there at In My Own Words Official. I'm on Facebook. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow me on Instagram. If you would directly like to talk to me without the public knowing, you can send it to my Gmail account. That's right. We can afford a Google. imowpodcast@gmail.com. Just send me your comments, your concerns, even questions. I don't even care if they're about movies or TV. Just send me a question. I can help you with some plumbing. It doesn't really matter. Just send them away. I'm glad to be here. I'm just glad to help. Remember, most importantly, to hashtag spread the word and make sure you like and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, Google, anywhere. Anywhere that you listen to podcasts, we're there. And if we're not somewhere, you send me that email and I'll make sure that that happens. We are paying an IT department an exuberant amount of money to make sure we are available everywhere because it should be easy to listen to. It should be easy. It really should. My name is Wes. Hashtag spread the word. And most importantly, don't go to any creepy clubs that involve spiders or tarantulas. Don't be that guy. You never know what could happen. They might grow huge. You don't know. All right? This is In My Own Words. And like usual, I will see you next time.